This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing Plato's Paradox of the Philosopher King and whether and how this paradox can be found inside the Star Trek universe. Mike, how are you today?
You know, I had a case of the bitter dregs right before we started podcasting, but I'm feeling great now. I feel like doing a little Vulcan dance, maybe around Captain Kirk's head. I'm just feeling it tonight. And how about you, Zachary? How are you doing today?
His brain is gone.
Well, I was doing better before I had a mental picture of you doing a Vulcan dance. Now I've got nothing. And I think it's usually me stunned into silence. Like, it's just so out in left field from where my mind was. I got nothing.
So technically, would that have been the, let me think about this for a second, would that have been the proto Dancing with the Stars?
Dancing?
I mean, seriously, think about this for a second. Would Spock's dance and Plato's stepchildren, would that have been the proto Dancing with the Stars?
Not dancing out in the stars, this is dancing with the stars.
So Zachary, all kidding aside, speaking of stars, we've got a couple more five-star ratings in the iTunes store. Thought it would be great if we would take a moment to acknowledge fans of the show who have been so thoughtful to leave us a star rating and write us a review. We received one this week from Phasers to Wellsby in the American store. Gave us a five-star rating, and he says, "I'm in my first year teaching philosophy, and this podcast has provided me with all kinds of ways to work Star Trek into my courses. Additionally, the hosts have helped me to both think about some philosophical concepts and Star Trek character episodes in ways I hadn't before. Good for anyone that wants a podcast that combines Greek culture with some heavy thinking."
What a great review.
That's a great review. And as a philosophy teacher yourself, Zachary, I'm sure you appreciate that one most.
I do, absolutely. You know, it was so fun to be able to use Star Trek references to teach philosophy when I was teaching philosophy. And of course, you know, I write and create online homework for philosophy courses nowadays, and I don't get much of a chance to talk about Star Trek in that context. So I'm glad we're providing people with yet another way to teach philosophy besides the more canonical non-Star Trek inspired approach.
We have another review, actually comes to us through the Irish iTunes store from Irish Trek Fan, and this one actually comes with a bit of a story. Zachary, you want to share that story?
Well, listeners who've been listening to Metatrex for a while will know that we just recently finished up an iTunes review contest where, you know, users on iTunes would leave a rating and a review of our show, and those names were entered into a hat and a name was drawn out, and the winner of the contest was given a Trek FM hoodie. And we're going to do another one of these iTunes review contests sometime in the next month or two. We'll do them periodically. But you know, in response to that contest, we got, you know, quite a few reviews on of the show on iTunes, and we thought we would take the time to read some of these reviews on the show, and so other listeners can hear some of the nice things people are saying about our show and what we're trying to do here on Metatrex with combining Star Trek and philosophy. The thing that's really hard, though, is keeping track of all of the reviews from different iTunes stores. There's international iTunes stores, and we don't get a notification when those reviews come in, and so it's hard to aggregate these reviews together in the first place. And when we listed the batch of people who'd given us reviews, we accidentally left one out, this user from the iTunes store in Ireland. So we apologize for that. And this is just a reminder, if you leave us a rating and a review of our show in one of the international iTunes stores, just send us a quick note to let us know that you left a review, and we'll make sure, you know, if we're doing a contest, we'll make sure we enter you into the contest. If we're reading reviews on the show, we'll make sure we've seen it, so we don't want to miss it. So we apologize. We felt really bad. We forgot to mention your review, and we're going to make up for it right now by reading your review.
And just to be clear, that the review was in the hat for the drawing, and if anyone's interested, we had a very happy fan who posted a picture of him sporting his brand new Word Bubble hoodie from our Redbubble store that we sent him with Aaron Harvey's fabulous Word Bubble design. He looked awfully happy in that hoodie, and we're looking forward to doing that in the future. So from our Irish iTunes store, Irish Trek fan, gave us a 5-star rating. He says, wonderful show. He says, I love this show. Zach and Mike always give a fresh spin on the Star Trek universe. Not only is it fun, but it's very thought-provoking as well. Keep it up, guys. And Irish Trek fan, we're so thankful that you listen to Metatrex on Trek.fm and that you are a fan of many of our shows here on the network. So continue listening. And again, we want to invite all of our listeners to take the time to leave us a star rating and write us a review in any iTunes store. And again, if you leave it in any of the other stores throughout the world, be sure and drop us a line. Let us know you did that so we can look your review up and possibly read it right here on the podcast.
Yeah, we really want to take the time to thank everyone for listening to the show, especially the people who take the time to leave us a rating and a review. But thanks to all of our listeners out there. We find it frankly amazing that you want to take the time to listen to us talk about Star Trek and philosophy every week. So for you loyal Metatrex listeners out there, thank you very much. We really appreciate your taking the time to listen to us talk about Star Trek and philosophy.
So Zachary, today we're going to talk about the paradox of the Philosopher King. So you think we should dive in?
Absolutely. So the paradox of the Philosopher King is a pretty easy topic to understand, really, and that's maybe why I picked it for the topic for the show tonight. It's not that the idea is particularly hard to understand, or that the paradox of the Philosopher King is particularly hard to understand. We're going to talk about some fun, interesting examples of what you call the paradox of the Philosopher King inside Star Trek. But I like talking about this topic because it's relevant for anyone who is either in a position of authority or someone who is particularly you know, well reasoned or well thought out. You know, it forces the issue of what the responsibilities of that person is. You know, what is the responsibility of a leader? What's the responsibility of someone who is aspiring to be a leader? What mm-hmm. is the what character traits should be cultivated that lead to a good kind of society? And these kinds of questions are all wrapped up in the paradox of the Philosopher King. So we want to talk about this in through the lens of Star Trek. But before we do that, let's give just a quick overview of what the paradox of the Philosopher King is. And as listeners may or may not know, the paradox of the Philosopher King is an idea that comes from the ancient Greek philosopher Plato in his Socratic dialogue, The Republic, which is really kind of a treatise on the ideal society. What kinds of political relationships are there? What kinds of character traits should be developed? How should the ideal society be formulated? And it asks these really kind of abstract political questions, like what is justice? What is truth? You know, what's the relationship between those concepts and the ideal society? And what's fascinating to me as we talk about the paradox of the Philosopher King, this background context, like what should the ideal society be, is very relevant to the Star Trek universe, because I think a lot of us Star Trek fans have something along the lines of the universe we see in Star Trek as our vision of the ideal society. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. When we think about Gene Roddenberry's original idea of this wagon train to the stars and this kind of utopian society that we call the Federation, that was hatched from his mind, you know, he wove a lot of ideas into this. I mean, Gene Roddenberry, at his essence, at his core, I know we don't recognize him officially as a philosopher. We think of him as a TV producer or a writer. But I think at Gene's core, He's a philosopher. And I think he is the philosopher king who sits on the throne of this utopian society that we call the Star Trek universe. So it's very relevant for any fan of Star Trek to at least have some familiarity. And I think it's really interesting that here in season 3 of the original series, and we're going to talk about this tonight, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you know, when we think about Plato's stepchildren, I think it's an interesting commentary in the realm of the Star Trek universe that is Gene Roddenberry's.
Yeah, this is an interesting idea that I hadn't really thought about until we started recording the show tonight, that Gene Roddenberry is essentially asking the same question that Plato and Socrates were asking inside the Republic. What is the ideal society? Mm-hmm. And by providing commentary on our current society and contrasting it with the way society could be, I mean, that's the virtue of putting a hypothetical universe out in the set sometime in the future, right? You can ask these hypothetical questions. What could the universe be like? What could our society be like? What kinds of progress can we make in the future that we can't foresee given the current situation for today? And by throwing the Star Trek universe into the future of a couple of centuries, you're able to ask these really idealistic questions. What should society be like, regardless of how it is today? And I think that's what's one of the defining characteristics of Plato as a thinker. You know, we're trying to make the connection between Plato's Republic and Star Trek. I think that's one of the defining characteristics of Plato as a thinker. He's an idealist in the sense that he's always more concerned with the way things ought to be, the ideal for a society, rather than how things necessarily are. And Gene Roddenberry falls right in that tradition, I think.
Oh, absolutely. We see it very prevalent throughout the original series. And for that matter, even when we get to, especially Star Trek The Next Generation, I think we really see Star Trek's version of Plato's The Republic really played out in 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Absolutely. And before we dive into the actual Star Trek part of the discussion, we should probably say what the paradox of the Philosopher King is.
After all, we are talking about the paradox.
We should probably say what it is, right? So the basic idea behind the paradox of the Philosopher King, it's a very simple idea, easy to understand, that the people who ought to be in charge, and it could be of society as a whole, like we're talking about in Plato's Republic, or maybe mm-hmm. in Star Trek, when we're talking about, you know, the Federation Council would be a good sort of analogous situation, right? The rulers of a given society, the people who are ultimately the decision makers. The people who should fill those positions often don't want to be in those positions. They don't seek power for its own sake. They don't, you know, they don't cultivate the kinds of virtues that lead to them being ready to be in a position of authority. So the people who are kind of most qualified, the people who are the meekest or the kindest or have the best sense of justice, whatever ideal you happen to think is necessary for a good ruler, those people are often very much not interested in being a ruler. And that's the basic idea behind the paradox of the Philosopher King. The people who should be in charge often don't want to be or aren't in a position to be in charge.
Zachary, I just had an incredible thought. And I know we kind of talked on the turbo lift coming to the podcast, but it just occurred to me that Martok is probably one of the best examples that I can think of the reluctant leader. He didn't want to be the leader of the Klingon Empire.
Yeah, and he had the opportunity, right?
You know,
arguably, he's one of the most virtuous Klingons, you know, maybe next to Worf, right?
Yes.
If Worf can't be the leader of the Klingon Empire, Martok's probably my second choice. And so he has the opportunity to become leader of the High Council.
If you think about what went on in that whole discourse, you know, at first, Worf was trying to convince Martok, whom Worf felt was most qualified to be the leader of the Klingon Empire, you know, stand up, challenge Gowron, and no, Worf, I'm just a soldier from the Kettle Lowlands, and that's not me. That's not who I am. Worf was able to see in him the greatness that the Klingon Empire needed, the humility and just the virtue to be the kind of leader that the Klingon Empire needed. And when push came to shove, and it was Worf who challenged Gowron, ultimately killed him. And they come and they bring, you know, that ceremonial robe, and they place it on Worf, and they're all Worf, Worf, Worf. He stops him, and he hands it, and he says, "Great men do not seek power; power is thrust upon them." And we have our philosopher king, Martok. It's perfect.
Yeah, what clearer example could we find of the philosopher king, right? I mean, someone who's too humble to want to be in a position of authority. I mean, that's kind of the definition of the paradox of the philosopher king, right? You're too humble. You don't seek the power that you would have in a position of authority. And then so I think there's variations of this, right? If you're too humble to accept the authority, that's one reason a qualified person might not want to be a leader. You can imagine a case where, you know, society is just set up in such a way that the people who are best prepared to be a good leader aren't allowed to kind of rise up through the ranks. There's some structural problem with the way society is set up.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any other reasons just off the top of your head before we dive into the meat of the topic why a qualified person might not end up as a leader, Mike?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned something broken, not allowing someone to rise up through the ranks. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why, Martok, found himself in the position that he was in. You know, when he was a young man, he wanted to, basically apply to the academy. He wasn't able to do that because of his heritage. Just being a commoner from the Kettle Lowlands, he wasn't nobility. We kind of saw that play out. That's one of the best examples I can think of. I do want to say, though, if I were a gawk-eating Klingon, I would follow Martok.
That's awesome. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking of another example. And again, we've kind of like abandoned our show notes at this point, but that's okay because these are great examples that are coming up in the spur of the moment. The example that came immediately to mind to me is in Star Trek Generations, when Captain Kirk tells Captain Picard, don't do anything that gets you out of the bridge of that ship, right? Don't let them promote you. Don't let them transfer you, because while you're in that chair, you can make a difference, right? And this is interesting because I think there's kind of this, call it a philosophical difference between Plato, who thinks that, the qualified person should be at the very top of the hierarchy, right? You know, the philosopher king is the one who should be in charge, and they should be at the top of the hierarchy. But I think you can imagine a situation which being at the top of the hierarchy actually decreases your ability to make a difference, right? If you're not actually doing the actual work of society, if you're not one of the worker bees, if you're not one of the people on the front lines fighting a war or making diplomatic decisions on the very front line, the kinds of things that Starship captains have to do day in and day out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're in a way you have less power and less authority as an admiral or as a member of the Federation Council. It's the captain sitting in the captain's chair that has the day-to-day ability to make a difference. And I think about my own career in some ways. I've been offered management positions before that I've turned down because I like being able to do hands-on work where I'm controlling the day-in, day-out business of getting things done. And I find that to be really, really powerful. And I think that's an interesting question. Is it even an ideal for the person in who's the most qualified to be at the highest level of the hierarchy, or is it more powerful to remain, the captain on the bridge of a starship, out there on the front lines and making decisions in the moment?
I think the question here was, are we doing a disservice pulling Martok out of the war? And I think they kind of explored that in DS9. They took him out of the war and put him at a desk. And Gowron kind of took over the management of the war, and it had detrimental effects. That's an interesting question. But in terms of the paradox of the philosopher king, so, there's the idea here that we're talking about someone rising through the ranks and, being the most unlikely and yet the most deserving. What are some other thoughts in terms of this paradox?
Well, I'm thinking now, Mike, of the relationship between authority and different levels of hierarchy in any hierarchical organization. And Plato definitely had the view that society is hierarchical. There's someone at the top of the decision-making chain, the philosopher king, and then sort of, maybe you might call them lieutenants kind of down below. And authority gets kind of distributed hierarchically. And eventually down at the bottom, you have people whose, skill set is the day-to-day business of the work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it just strikes me that at every level of a hierarchy, there's people who will rise to fill that role based on their skill set and based on their temperaments, based on the virtues that they've cultivated. And at a certain point, You know, I think one of two things happens. You know, you get, you know, say you succeed at a certain level and you get, and of course we're kind of deviating from Plato here. Plato had this idea that you would identify, you know, people fairly early on in terms of what their skill set and temperament is and what their virtues are, and you would kind of place them in a very stratified society. So it's really unlikely that someone would move from one rank to another inside Plato's society. It was very, very rigid and hierarchical in that way. But, you know, but I'm thinking more like a management structure, and you're a manager, Mike, in your profession. So I'm thinking at a certain point, you know, you succeed and so you get promoted into something, and either you're going to succeed or you're going to fail at that, right? And then eventually you're going to succeed and you're going to succeed and you might get promoted to a certain level. And one of two things happens. I think either you really are really great at cultivating that next level of leadership writ large, right? Being able to see the big picture and think about an organization as a whole. And of course, we're talking about society now, so society as a whole, right? The captain of a starship doesn't necessarily have to think about the Federation as a whole, right? But admirals have to think about that a bit more, and leaders of the Federation Council are charged with thinking about that a bit more. But at a certain level of the hierarchy, either you're going to sort of succeed all the way up, or at some point you're going to be promoted into a role where you fail and you're just not qualified anymore to have that level of authority or that level of influence.
Yeah. And I see that every day in the business world. You know, one of the biggest challenges that, you know, a manager has is to, develop, his leaders, his or her leaders. And I think probably the best example of this is in the Star Trek universe is that in the role of a first officer. Traditionally, we think of a first officer as a captain in training, probably would be the best term. It's the executive officer, is someone who is standing there just intimately involved in the decisions that the captain's making. They're learning on the job, if you will, and a good captain ultimately will promote that first officer onto something else. And so that kind of brings me to one of the problems I think that at least I have with this philosophical idea of the philosopher king. In that paradox, Zachary, is the idea that Plato had, that in order to have a just society, you need to have just people. But in order to be just people, you need to have a just society. So therein lies a paradox, and a very difficult paradox indeed.
Yeah, and you can see this in Plato's Republic, right? I think if you're going to raise people up, for, you know, this is Plato now, if you're going to raise people up for to serve in the role of a philosopher king, or even the next level down, some sort of, you know, guardian position where you're, you know, overseeing something really large, you know, you have to provide an educational environment that cultivates the learning of those kinds of virtues. And this is part of the reason Plato created his academy, right? Plato himself had created an academy training people in mathematics and abstract thinking and whatnot. He was really wanted to cultivate an environment in which you could develop those virtues and that skill set to think abstractly. And we'll talk a bit about how that feeds into the paradox of the philosopher king and Plato's view of an idealized society in a minute. But I think you're right that if you want to cultivate the right kinds of virtues, you have to have that takes a certain kind of environment.
Sure.
And then when you have created that certain kind of environment, it creates the right kinds of people. There's kind of this cyclical relationship there that is, it's hard if you don't have that in advance. If you don't have an ideal society, you don't have people who are qualified, what's the starting point? Like, how do you go about developing something from scratch if you don't have the right people and you don't have the right society, kind of society that cultivates, you know, whatever virtues are necessary for a good society?
Yeah. I think about, and of course, I think the quintessential first officer would be Will Riker. And we think about the relationship that he had with Picard, and Picard kind of being, if you will, the model of the model major general. No, the model of a perfect starship captain, and Jean-Luc Picard is certainly a philosopher in his own right. Picard was able to mentor a young, cocky, ambitious Will Riker, and over the course of those 7 years, through 7 years of Star Trek: The Next Generation, we see Will mature. We see him really become someone who, in his own right, would be an outstanding starship captain. But you take a Will Riker and put him with, say, Captain Ransom, that we met in Star Trek Voyager, who is not the perfect model of a model starship captain.
Yeah, that would not have been an environment in which Riker would have flourished, I think, right? Riker would have been viewed, I mean, at least not on the ship. I don't think Riker would have been a terribly effective first officer. I don't think he would have been viewed as an effective first officer. In fact, even when Captain Jellico is given command of the Enterprise D, you know, he views Riker as quote, not a particularly good first officer, right?
Yes.
And of course, Riker replies that, you know, Jellico is not a particularly good captain while the ranks are dropped and they can speak honestly to one another inside Riker's quarters. But that's interesting. You're kind of taking an interesting take on this paradox of the Philosopher King, that in order for someone to flourish in their certain role, they have to be in a certain kind of environment, and absent that environment, that person's just not going to flourish. And you know, as an educator, that makes sense to me. And you know, I think if there are any parents out there, I think that would make sense to parents that are out there. But again, I think, you know, Plato has an interesting dilemma in the Republic, which is that in Plato's time, there's a lot of particularly corrupt politicians. There's no educational environment for the kind of society that he wants to create. So he's faced with a real problem. He doesn't have either a good society. He doesn't have the good people. And so how do you go about creating this from scratch? You know, I think in terms of Starfleet officers, you've got generally an atmosphere in which Starfleet officers can flourish. There's a way of moving up the ranks. You're generally assigned to people who aren't morally corrupt or aren't power hungry or whatnot. And, you know, the society as a whole ends up pretty good. But absent that, what's the starting point? And I think we're in a similar situation today, right? We look forward into the Star Trek future and we see, you know, what we see on screen. We see in a society that we as Star Trek fans would really like to be in, I think. You know, there's some ideals that really don't exist in today's society, whether they're ideals of tolerance, whether they're ideas of diplomacy, exploration. You know, these things haven't come into fruition and we're faced with a dilemma. How do we go about building that kind of society given that the basic building blocks don't yet exist?
Yeah. And as best you can do, you have to identify, you know, good performance, and then you have to develop that person to be qualified for that next level. Our fabulous producer, Dennis Costello, said a note here. It's referred to as the Peter Principle, that idea that you're going to select a candidate for a position based on their current performance in the role that they're in, you know, rather than the idea that the abilities are suited for that role. And we do that in the business world. We see that in the Star Trek universe. And yeah.
Well, Mike, I love that we're making connections we didn't plan on making tonight. It's amazing. I think this is what's fun about having a couple of minds sitting together and talking about Star Trek and philosophy. You never know what's going to come up and be fruitful. But we did promise we would talk about the actual paradox of the Philosopher King. And I had in mind we would talk about Plato's Stepchildren, the episode from the third season of the original series, which mentions the idea of a Philosopher King explicitly. So let's give a quick overview of the paradox of the Philosopher King from Plato's point of view. And, you know, Plato's take on this is essentially that the people who should be in charge are the people who have the ability to understand justice and the sort of the ideal form of a good society in itself. And I want to give just a little bit of background on Plato and why this makes sense. I think when you first encounter the idea of the Philosopher King, it's such a weird phrase, right? Philosopher King. Why should philosophers be in charge of anything? And I think in order to understand the intuition there, you just need to understand a couple of simple things about Plato that make that idea make sense. One is this idea from Plato that not only do particular things exist in the world, but also there are sort of idealized forms exist in some really existing metaphysical sense. I think Plato really thought forms in the abstract sense exist. And so by forms, he means just sort of a generalized, idealized concept in its own sake. Like you can find examples of just actions inside the world, right? You know, walking an old lady across the street is a just action, right? Helping someone else in need, that's a just action. What's a just action inside the Star Trek universe, Mike? Pick your favorite example.
Oh, anytime a distress call is given, it amazes me that we can drop everything that we're doing and go to the rescue. And we see that's often the starting point for some of our favorite Star Trek stories.
Yeah, that's a great example. Rushing to the aid of the Kobayashi Maru, right? That yes. is a just action inside the Star Trek universe, right? So Plato's basic intuition here is that there's just actions. You can list a bunch of them, as many as you want, but then there's justice itself, right? What does justice mean? Not this example of justice, not that example of justice, not this just action or that just action, but justice in the abstract, justice itself. And mm-hmm. I guess the thing that's unique about Plato is Plato thinks that really exists. There's a form of justice that exists in some different metaphysical realm that's different from the world we see around us, in which those just actions actually occur. And so in Plato's mind, whoever is best able to understand justice itself, justice in the abstract, is best prepared to make judgment on those individual just actions, right? Which actions are just, which actions are not just, and be prepared to kind of build a society that instantiates this abstract form of justice. And another part of Plato's Republic that I think is helpful in making sense of the paradox of the philosopher king is what's known as the allegory of the cave. And, we could probably spend 10 minutes just talking about the allegory of the cave, which we're not going to do. I'm going to give you the really quick version of the allegory of the cave. The basic idea of the allegory of the cave is, imagine there are these prisoners stuck inside of a cave. It's, you know, it's down inside of a cave. It's dark inside there. And imagine that behind these prisoners, they're chained somewhere in the cave, staring at a wall, staring at a dark wall. Behind the prisoners, there's a fire burning. And so past the prisoners, the light is shining, it's casting shadows on the wall. And now suppose these prisoners were born and raised inside this cave, right? They're stuck inside the cave, and all they've known is the experience of being in the darkness, staring at these shadows on the wall. Basically, Plato's idea is that the prisoners would mistake the shadows for reality, right? That would be their sort of limited picture of what reality is like. And there would even be people who are really good at identifying certain kinds of shadows, right? Maybe there's some workers behind the fire, you know, carrying a hammer, or carrying a screwdriver, or whatnot. And they could see these different shaped shadows. And the prisoners would get really good at identifying these different kinds of shadows and the patterns and anticipating what will come and whatnot. They might even debate amongst themselves, you know, which kind mm-hmm. of shadow is that? Which kind of shadow is this? But the mistake that they're making, of course, is that they're just shadows on the wall. They don't have any other sense of reality. Now, suppose one of the prisoners breaks free of the chains and manages to crawl his or her way up outside of outside the cave and get into the sunlight. Plato would say, you know, there's this transition period, like you're blinded by the light. You're so used to being in the dark. You can't understand being in the light. You're overwhelmed by it. You at first want to resist it. You want to run back into the cave for safety because, you know, your eyes are being blinded. But eventually you transition, you start to realize, your eyes get open, you realize, you know, the what you've been used to experiencing as reality is just shadows on the wall. There's some bigger sense of reality that you hitherto haven't recognized or haven't been aware of. And once the light bulb goes on, in fact, this is where we get a lot of the original sort of metaphors of light, right? This is this rich tradition of saying that knowledge is illuminating, right? Mm-hmm. This is kind of the original source for that for that concept. You know, Plato would say that, you know, once you've realized that the lights have gone on, you understand there's more to reality than the things you were experiencing, there's this urge to kind of rush back into the cave and tell everyone about it, right? You want to run into the cave, tell them, you guys aren't seeing the full picture. You know everything you're used to is just shadows on the wall, and there's this light outside the cave and all this this extra level of reality. And what do you think the prisoner's reaction would be? You're crazy, man. Yeah. And that's essentially, you know, part of the allegory of the cave. The prisoners eventually, they don't like hearing that what they think of reality is false, that it's just shadows, that it's not really real.
Right.
And so they resist it. But eventually, you know, maybe the protagonist of the story manages to break the other prisoners free or set them free and sort of drags them kicking and screaming, you know, up the ramp to the mouth of the cave. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're blinded by the light too, but eventually the lights go on. But I think Plato's metaphor is interesting because he thinks that there's kind of an obligation. Once you've obtained a certain kind of knowledge, or once you've been able to understand something in itself, justice in itself, or pick any other Platonic concept like truth or beauty, the kinds of things that are mentioned inside Plato's Stepchildren, the episode, right? Yes. Kirk tells Parman that Plato is interested in justice and truth and beauty, right? These pure abstract forms for their own sake. Mm-hmm. And once you've developed understanding of those kinds of abstract concepts, Plato thinks there's kind of an obligation to just sort of rush back into the cave and help spread the knowledge.
Yeah.
But if you're going to really be able to be in a position to distinguish between what justice is and what justice isn't, or what actions are good or what actions are not, or trying to set up a society that has this property of being a just society, then you want someone who really does have this abstract understanding of justice in itself and not being able to merely point at shadows on the wall. And so shadows on the wall here are you could call them...
Unimatrix Zero.
Yeah. That's awesome. So... The shadows on the wall are analogous to the particular examples of just actions in the world, right? You can point to the just actions, like rushing to the aid of the Kobayashi Maru or walking an old lady across the street. Those are mere shadows of this idealized form of justice. So if you're going to make correct judgments about those, you need to first sort of understand what justice is in itself. So in Plato's mind, the ideal ruler for a society would be someone who really does understand, not just be able to identify the correct shadows on the wall and make these practical maneuverings in society, but really have an ideal sense of what society should be in the abstract. And that's who the ideal ruler should be. So that's what's driving the idea of the philosopher king for Plato, this idea that there are abstract forms to define concepts in their own sake, and also that there's an obligation to sort of rush back into the cave and help drag the rest of society towards understanding, you know, those ideals. And it's just, and I think this is just such a practical point. It's so easy to be involved in our day-to-day lives, or in Star Trek land, it's so easy to be involved in the day-to-day runnings of a starship, right? You know, all the minutiae involved in, you know, making sure the warp core is up and running, and making sure, you know, you get your duty shift on time, and we have
duty
these
rosters,
duty rosters, you know, crew evaluations, right? Remember that episode where Riker and Troy are sitting up doing crew evaluations all night?
Yes.
Right. So it's so easy to be involved in the day-to-day minutiae of life, whether for us as a society, or whether it's in Star Trek, that you forget to focus on the ideals. And so Plato is really trying to give a strong reminder that it's important to focus on the ideals. And that's who we think should be in charge of society. So really, that's what's driving this idea behind the philosopher king. And I think on the surface, it sounds like a crazy idea, because we have this idea of the philosopher as kind of this bumbling idiot. Maybe people think of me that way. Uh-oh, the mirror was just shining. The light just went on. I just stepped outside the cave. People tend to think of philosophers as kind of this bumbling idiot. Like the first philosopher in the Western world was Thales, and he was known for looking up at the sky so much, trying to understand the heavens, that he fell into a well. And he didn't have his feet on the ground. He wasn't paying attention to what's going on around him. So why would you put that guy?
That would be
yeah, right. Why would you put that guy in charge of society if he's not paying attention and falling into a well, right? But Plato's idea is that it's the philosopher who's able to understand the abstract concepts that are necessary to really understanding justice in its own sake, and really best prepared to bring an idealized society into existence. So put the philosophers in charge. Is his idea. But the paradox is that the people who seek knowledge for its own sake and seek wisdom for its own sake, or seek justice for its own sake, are the very people who are absolutely not at all interested in power for its own sake, and they don't seek out positions of power.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, many philosophers would argue, Zachary, when you talk about shadows on a wall, that, and this is a topic for another edition of Metatrex, but many philosophers would argue that the life that we're living now is the shadows on a wall, that there is something more out there. There's a greater illuminated existence. And I find this all fascinating. You mentioned Plato's stepchildren. And so I think it would be appropriate to pause for a second and just talk briefly about that particular episode from the third season of the original series. And it's a episode that gets its inspiration quite literally from this topic that we're discussing, the paradox of the philosopher king. So what happens in this episode, as we discussed, it kind of all starts with a distress call. Dr. McCoy lends help to a leader of a planet populated by people who have these kind of telekinetic abilities, who after 2,000 years ago visiting Earth, they become enamored with the Greek culture. So they have gone back to their home planet, and they have established a utopian society based on the Greek culture and Greek ideals. But they have incredible powers, and so they've become somewhat corrupt, and they decide to try to force Dr. McCoy to stay by torturing Captain Kirk and Spock and Uhura and Nurse Chapel. And I should mention that there is actually, Zachary, a historic kiss that takes place in this episode. It is the first time ever in the history of television that a Vulcan kisses a nurse.
That's where Dennis is going to insert that sound clip. Like, I got nothing, right?
His brain is gone.
You thought I was going to say the first interracial kiss, didn't you?
Well, yeah, and I didn't, yeah. And my brain is gone.
It was such an awkward kiss, too. Can you imagine me and Leonard Nimoy? And, you know, you got to go in there and do this scene, and you're thinking the whole time, oh, my God, you know, I'm kissing the boss's wife or mistress, whatever she was at the time.
I hope my green makeup doesn't rub off on her, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You have a little green makeup on your lips there now. Sorry about that.
But this is a fascinating episode. All kidding aside, again, based on this paradox.
Well, it's funny, Mike, that you mentioned. It's funny that you mentioned, you know, the kissing in this episode, because, you know, all joking aside, this is, you know, well, yes, known as the first interracial kiss on television, and I love the fact that this happens inside this episode, right? Because the, you know, what Roddenberry I think is commenting on here is the. He's commenting on our own society, right? He's putting that in there because, mm-hmm, that's a weakness of our own society, this racial perspective that we have. It's something, yes, he wants us to move beyond, right? And that is a question of ideals. What kind of society should we build? And I love that he's putting this in the context of Plato's Stepchildren, when the discussion of an idealized society and the philosopher king. And of course, what I love about this episode are the many ways that the Platonians get Plato wrong, right? They have a couple things right, and they get an awful lot wrong, right? They're not really a good example of Plato. But I love that in the middle of all this bastardization of Plato, you get, you know, what is essentially a bastardization of our own society, right? You get something that's wrong about our own society. The fact that people are judgmental about something like an interracial kiss, you know, in this society in the 1960s, that's something he wants us to move beyond. So he's juxtaposing this question of ideals and what society should be with some of the things that are wrong about our own society. But again, all put in the future, all put in this really fanciful story about Plato's stepchildren out in outer space, you know, calling back to you know, the original thinker of an ideal society. It's a really, you know, it's really not the best episode of Star Trek, but it's a brilliant juxtaposition of everything that's right about our society and everything that's wrong about our society, everything that's right about that Plato had right, and everything that, mm-hmm, the Platonians get wrong about Plato. It's really brilliant in its construction when you start to make those comparisons.
Well, there's some really interesting points in this particular episode that come right out of Plato's Republic, and I think they deserve mentioning. One of the things, Zachary, that you have note here is that philosopher kings have no need of titles.
Yeah, this is a quote from Parman, the, you know, the ruler, mm-hmm, of the Platonian society, right? He says, Captain Kirk is trying to address him, and he sort of says, you know, who are you? And he says, you know, philosopher kings have no need of titles. And that's something that I feel like the Platonians get right about Plato, right? Plato is right that, you know, a genuine philosopher king wouldn't need a title, wouldn't need the position of authority, wouldn't need the adoration or the recognition, right? So that's sounds like a good shade of Plato. Philosopher kings don't, mm-hmm, need those things. I'm not interested in adoration for its own sake, right? So I feel like that's you know, check one in the plus column for you know, how much the Platonians got Plato right. But then very quickly we're going to see they get a lot wrong.
Yeah, indeed. You want to go ahead and continue?
Yeah, one of the things that just cracks me up a bit about this episode is this bit about the telekinesis.
Yes.
The fact that the Platonians can move things with their minds and control other people with their minds, make Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura kiss, you know, all being controlled by the will, the mental willpower of the Platonians.
Well, the idea here, Zachary, is with the right diet, you can do anything.
Right. I feel stronger already, right? Eat my space Wheaties, right? My breakfast of Quadro Triticale. Eat enough Quadro Triticale, you can move mountains.
It sounds like a green leafy vegetable. I'm probably not interested.
But seriously, what I just simultaneously love and I hate this. What I love about it is this emphasis on the non-physical, right? The fact that, mm-hmm, there's some sort of mental power shows that the Platonians latched onto the fact that what's important is the mind, and what's important are ideas, and what's important is what you can, you know, do with your abstract thought. That is very much, you know, harkening back to Plato. The bit about telekinesis and controlling other people is ridiculous. Right? That, first of all, it has nothing to do with Plato. So anyone who's watching this and hasn't read Plato, hasn't, you know, done much philosophy before. You know, Plato was not into telekinesis. I'll just put that out right now. But so, and what's absurd about it, though, you can see kind of the abuse of power that's happening here, right? Once the Platonians develop this power, it takes them about a week for them to start, you know, controlling other people and being not a just ruler, but they turn into a society of I don't know, what would you call it? What's the best word to use, Mike? They're a society. They're not just rulers. They're what?
They're unjust. I mean, they're corrupt. They, you know, the old saying
they're
is
dictators.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Parmen makes a statement in Plato's Stepchildren. He says, uncontrolled power will turn even saints into savages, and we can all be counted on to live down to our lowest impulses. I think that's profound.
And that's yet another shade on this idea of the philosopher king, right? So one version of the paradox of the philosopher king is that people who should be in charge don't want to be, right? Mm-hmm. Another version is that in order to cultivate the kinds of virtues, you need a society that allows you to cultivate those virtues. That's the version of the paradox that you mentioned a few minutes ago. And now we have this sort of new version, right? That power is corrupting. That once you're in a position of authority, you know, power can be seductive, and power can you can start to abuse your power and do things that are unjust, because and it becomes comfortable. And what's interesting about the Platonians, and I think this is something that is brilliant, you know, by giving them a very long lifespan, you can see the, you know, sort of long-term slide into the abuse of power that this group of individuals have had, right? You know, it's not like they get power and then all of a sudden, boom, they're evil people. It's like they've become used to having this power, right? They can't mm-hmm. imagine not having it. And they just take it for granted that anything they want, they can manifest, they can control other people. And Parmen says as much in the episode. Parmen basically says, you know, you have to understand, Captain Kirk, that anything my mind wants gets willed into existence, right? So don't judge me too harshly. And of course, that's not terribly genuine. It's a little disingenuous, but you know, you can see that the fact that these individuals have been living for, you know, 2,500 years at least, you know, since the time of Plato, they've had this sort of deep dark slide back into the cave, to use the cave metaphor again.
Yeah, and you know, Barbara Babcock, who really gives a great performance and a beautiful lady. You know, it's interesting because her character is so vain. You know, she's very enamored with her own beauty, and it makes a point of saying, you know, she's well over, you know, 2,000 years old, and you know, don't I look great? And she does, by the way, but she looks fabulous. But it's just interesting that slow slide back into the cave. And then you have the other side of the coin. You have Alexander, who by virtue of his disability, you know, identifying himself as a dwarf, because of that, he wasn't able to develop these telekinetic powers from the diet that they were eating. And so he's kind of become the fool in the philosopher king's court. But he possesses the type of virtue that Kirk recognizes as being ideal to lead, you know, such a society. But, you know, he doesn't want to take Parmen's place as a ruler. And even though he is become so bitter towards Parmen, he doesn't take action. He doesn't give in to his own hatred, and he doesn't want the power thrust upon him.
Yeah,
he just wants out of there.
Once he gets this, once he develops this telekinesis power, right? You know, the power. In the episode, they call it the power, right? Once you get the power, he's really given the opportunity. He could, you know, outwit Parmen or kill Parmen and take his place as ruler. And he's given the opportunity to do that. And he essentially doesn't want to do it. And when he starts to wield power, like he takes the knife and he's ready to kill Parmen towards the end of the episode, you know, Captain Kirk says, do you want to be like him? Why would you want to do that? Right. You're going to end up being just like the very thing that you hate.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Alexander is very much, you know, more positioned to be a genuine philosopher king. Like if he was in charge of the society, it would be a much more just society. He has virtues, that the other characters, the other Platonians don't have. So yeah, I think I love that Alexander is put in there, and I just love the contrast. You know, he's diminutive and he's not self-confident, and he's been told his entire life that he's the reason he doesn't have the power is because he's dim-witted, essentially. And you know, all of that has served to cultivate the kind of virtue that makes him not power hungry and makes him more gentle and makes him not abuse other people. And he's a perfect candidate for a philosopher king, but of course he doesn't end up as ruler at the end of the day, right? So that's the fully enacting Plato's prediction jurisdiction that the people who should be in charge very often don't end up in charge and very often don't want to be.
I think we missed an opportunity in the JJ verse, though, because, you know, at the end of the episode, and I don't want to give away any spoilers, at the end of the episode, you know, Captain Kirk says to Scotty, you know, hey, I'm bringing a guest, and it's kind of a joke at the end. And I was watching this episode, and I thought to myself,
guest who's coming to dinner?
Doggone it! You know, why couldn't we have made him Scotty's sidekick in the JJ verse? Just saying, I think we missed an opportunity there.
He'd be taking over the Enterprise, right?
No, he would instead of Deep Roy's little character. I think his name's Keenzer. Keenzer, that's it, Keenzer. Yeah, instead of Keenzer, we could have had Alexander.
This is really interesting. What, you know, this is sort of like in my own headcanon now. I'm imagining Keenzer as given the opportunity to command the Enterprise, and he's the most qualified person, he's the best captain, he's the most gentle, he's the most just, and he turns it down so he can work with Scotty in the engine room.
Yeah, and he's sitting on top of the engine, and Scotty says, "Get down from there."
Yeah, that happened right before Star Trek 2009 started. We didn't see that part. Right? So getting back to Plato's Stepchildren really quickly, there's some other things that I love about this. One of the things that the Platonians get wrong is just this idea that in fact, it's a line from the episode. Parman says, "Justice is the will of the stronger mind," and he thinks of that as a virtue, right? That look, we, you know, in our society, whoever has this develops mm-hmm. the strongest mind ends up in charge because they can manifest whatever they want. But it becomes a type of power play, and that's just this kind of fundamental misunderstanding of what justice in its purest form is. And Captain Kirk rightly says that, you know, we're interested in justice in its own sake, or Plato is interested in justice for its own sake, and Parman says, well, here in our society, you know, we've got the most democratic society because all of us can cultivate our minds and develop anything we want. We're all equal to each other because we've all developed our minds, and it's the most democratic type of society. So this really awful skewing of what Plato had in mind, the Platonians argue, has presented the most ideal type of society, and they've convinced themselves of this is what's fascinating, right? They're so delusional. They're like the prisoners living inside Plato's cave, staring at the walls, right? They've so deluded themselves about what an ideal could be like that this terrible society they've constructed has become the ideal to them in their own minds.
Well, having limited their experience to ancient Greece, they robbed themselves of the opportunity to become stewards of Kantian ethics. Honestly.
But I think this, you know, this is just, what's fun to me is just, this is true of people in general, right? I think, you know, if you haven't had your eyes open, if you don't see a different way of doing things, if you're living a comfortable kind of life, you very often just accept that as the ideal, right? And this is the mistake Plato is trying to talk us out of, right? He doesn't want you to mistake the way things are for the way they ought to be, right? And that's a fundamental division inside Plato's thinking. Even you mentioned Kantian ethics, that's a fundamental division in Kantian ethics. You could lay it down as an axiom for ethics, right? And I can imagine Spock here saying, well, I would accept it as an axiom that you can't argue from the way things are to the way things ought to be, right? And that's what the mistake that Plato's stepchildren here, the Platonians, are making, right? They've kind of convinced themselves that because we have this power and because we've set up a society, we can manifest anything we want. This is the best kind of society because look at all this power we have, right?
Yeah.
And that is just a fundamental, I think, just a bad move in ethics, right? It's a misunderstanding of what an ideal ought to be. And another little side note that I find interesting, I love that the Platonians cite democracy as an ideal because this is, again, kind of a subtle misunderstanding of Plato. Plato wasn't a fan of democracy. He was very critical of democracy, right? Because he thought it was really tyranny of the masses. He thought that most people are still kind of stuck in the cave and haven't really taken the time to develop their minds to think mathematically or think abstractly, to think about justice in its own purest sense, right? To think about justice in the abstract. People are still stuck debating about shadows on the wall, about things that aren't right, don't matter as much, that aren't as real. They are, you know, at best sort of impure shadows of more ideal forms. And Plato just thought that most people live in that world, right? That most people just haven't taken the time to develop those skills. So why would you put those people in charge is Plato's fundamental insight. So Plato is very much anti-democracy. And it kind of makes me chuckle a little bit that the Platonians inside the episode say that we've created the most democratic kind of society because we have all this power. Already it's a weird relationship between power and democracy that I'm not quite sure I understand. At very least, it's a misunderstanding of Plato. So if they if they had traveled to Earth back in the time of Plato and Socrates, and they picked up on the ideals of Platonic society, it's funny that they misinterpreted it to the point where they would think that democracy is a good thing. And of course, for us in an American society, you know, we tend to think democracy is a good thing. We want people who to be empowered to make decisions, because we're very skeptical of authority and power. We want people to live a free life that they determine themselves. This kind of self-determination, self-autonomousness is not an ideal Plato had so much, but it's an ideal that we have. So what I love about thinking about the paradox of the philosopher king and about this question of democracy and authority and hierarchy and how all these concepts affect us in our own lives, what is the relationship between who a ruler should be? You know, because being a ruler takes power, right? Even being a president of the United States takes power, right? You can't be in a position of authority without some power, military or otherwise, to kind of back it up, right?
Yeah.
And so what's the relationship between a generally empowered, free, autonomous society and authority? And this is a question that the founding fathers of our country had to wrestle with when they were determining, you know, thinking about how to set up society. This is a question that Plato had to deal with. You know, how do you simultaneously rush back into the cave and help those people sort of open their eyes and help them understand things that they didn't, you know, previously understand, you know, educate them, in other words, and simultaneously recognize that you need a ruler who is best prepared to make decisions for society as a whole. And those look like they contradict each other, and every society has to wrestle with that in some way, shape, or form. But for Plato, the ideal definitely wasn't democracy. It was quite the other direction. He had a totally stratified society. People were identified at a very early age. This person has an aptitude towards abstract thinking. This person has an aptitude for wielding a weapon, so put them out on the front lines, and that was your station in society, and that was that, and there wasn't a lot of movement between. Whereas we tend to prefer sort of a flattened hierarchy, where with a lot of movement between different classes of society as a democratic ideal. But Plato really does force the issue, forces you to think about the issue, and what should the relationship between authority and the free will or liberty of the individual people be? And, you know, Plato had one answer that is not too appealing for us as a democratic society. I love that the Platonians misinterpreted Plato in this regard, and they've managed to convince themselves that their own society is great because it's the most democratic, because they've got this overwhelming mental power that they've taken to be a virtue. But I don't have the answer to this, but I think it's a fascinating issue that every society in any time period, whether now or in the future, has to wrestle with. I mean, in Star Trek universe, you have to wrestle with this, right? You know, what's the relationship between having a lot of, you know, movement, being able to choose anything you might want to do, and yet you still need, the society still needs protection, right? So you need to have something like a military. You have, you know, that's why you put phasers on a starship, right?
Yeah. But in a just society, you don't need a military.
Is that true? Actually, Plato didn't think that, because Plato did think that you're going to have invaders, you're going to need to fight wars, and these are practical things that are, you know, people. Plato kind of gets a bad rap for not thinking practically. In fact, one of his Socrates's interlocutors inside the Republic basically challenges and said, you know, this is a totally idealized society. It's not practical, right? This vision of a society that you've described with a philosopher king and different levels and all this education, you know, the kind of thing Plato was trying to do with developing an academy, you know, all that sounds great, but it's so idealized. It's not practical. And, you know, but at the same time, Plato's thinking, well, there are going to be invaders sometimes. You have to have a military, right? You can't ignore that. So yeah. I think even Plato would say that a just society has to have those practical concerns.
I raised that objection simply because I wanted to note that in the episode, Philana says something to the effect that they had engineered their society down to, I think the number was 39 people. So they basically eliminated their entire population, with the exception of these 39 people, perfect to sustain our utopian society. So they had to get rid of all the undesirables, except for Alexander, who they kept around just to be their court fool, their court jester. And which I think we missed a great opportunity there for a 47 reference. I think that should have been 47 left in their utopian society. But I digress.
You know, but you're mentioning sort of weeding out the imperfections, and I'm now thinking of that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, the one where the society that kind of lives in a self-sustaining bubble where everyone is, their role is predetermined, they're all genetically engineered. But that episode there is very much a shade of this, where each person in that society has had their role determined from birth. Those virtues are cultivated, like the leader of that society knows he's going to be a good leader. He has all the skills. He's born to lead, right? The musicians are born to be artists, right? That is very much like what Plato has in mind, that there are just some people that have natural inclinations like that. And you know, good leaders in that case, you know, what's fascinating about that society is it's almost like a perfect instantiation of Plato's idealized society, right? The leader is born to lead. There's no question of that leader wanting to be a leader, right? That leader knows from a very early age that he's supposed to be a leader. All those virtues are cultivated. He's educated to be a leader, has all the formative experiences, and lo and behold, he ends up the leader. It sort of circumvents this, this philosopher king paradox. And I think that speaks to a really important point. There's a danger involved here. If you can find a way of circumventing the philosopher king paradox, if you could genetically engineer your leaders and you could genetically engineer all the other roles of society, that ends up like looking like a very stratified, non-democratic society that I don't think you want to live in, and I don't think I want to live in. It's just like Picard thinks they've bred out all the humanity of that society, right? In that episode, that's not Plato's society, and I love that. That's a really forceful challenge against Plato's ideal this idea of a stratified society where the ruler knows that he's born to be a ruler. That's not necessarily a good society either. It's very, very critical of this idea of the philosopher king.
So, Zachary, we are rolling up on an hour, and so I'm really feeling the vibe to do my Vulcan flamenco dance. But before we do, we probably should.
Pay money to see that. Our listeners would. Our listeners would donate more on Patreon if they could see you doing that.
I tell you what, we hit the next milestone level. I will totally go YouTube and do a Vulcan flamenco dance around Christopher Jones's head. I totally would do that. Or better yet, I'd let Christopher Jones do a Vulcan flamenco dance around my head. How's that?
Well, there it is, folks.
There it is. There's the challenge.
Again, so you've blown my mind. I've got no response to that. So
his brain is gone.
Okay. So question here. A couple of great examples quickly before we go to final thoughts and finish today's podcast. A couple of great examples of a philosopher king in Star Trek. We already mentioned Martok, so I'll leave that one in the discussion where it is.
Oh, you're asking me. Sorry. I thought you were going to say it. Sorry.
I'm asking you.
The fun example that comes to my mind is Rom. Rom, who becomes the Grand Nagus at the end of Deep Space Nine, right? So I sort of think of Rom. You know, Rom, he's not power hungry. Mm. He may not be the brightest guy on the planet, right? He's an engineer, so he at least has some skills. But Rom is not power hungry. So in that sense, he's not an abusive leader. He's not a power hungry leader, and ends up becoming the Grand Nagus, right? The leader of the Ferengi society, or the Ferengi economy, the leader of the Ferengi economy. But I sort of think of Rom as, I'm trying to think of another way to describe the paradox of the philosopher king now in terms of Rom. Rom is an example of the paradox of the philanthropist Grand Negus. That's my Ferengi version of the paradox of the philosopher king. Right? Rom is a gentle soul, kind to other people, and he ends up leader of the Ferengi economy as Grand Negus. So the philanthropist Grand Negus.
There you go. And what a philosopher he is, isn't he?
I'm not sure he understands justice in itself. So he may not really meet Plato's criterion for a philosopher king, but he's at least someone who's an unlikely candidate who's risen through the ranks. And we've seen examples of that in our own society, right? Like I'm thinking of like someone like Gerald Ford, right? Mm-hmm. The most unlikely person to be president. He ends up nominated as vice president, ends up becoming president, was never an ambition. And you can find these real tales like this where someone who, you know, was an unlikely candidate to be in a position of authority, ends up becoming president of the United States. And Harry Truman was a great example of someone like that, right?
Yeah.
Just a few years before he was president, he was running his own haberdashery, right? And, you know, and he ends up president of the United States, you know, against all odds. And that kind of thing happens. And against all odds, Rom has become the Grand Negus. You know, no one would have predicted that in a million years, but that kind of thing happens. I'm not sure he's a philosopher king, but he's at least not a power hungry individual.
Yeah. And of course I'm making a leap here to assume that Odo in some ways became the leader of the changelings. But I think about Odo when I think about the Philosopher King, the paradox of the Philosopher King. You know, Odo was the outcast, and yet he finds himself in a position to go back and really, in many ways, lead his people. I think he's a great example.
Yeah, I think anytime in Star Trek you get an example of someone who is not seeking to rise up the ranks, you got a good example of the paradox of the Philosopher King, right? Riker, I call Riker the captain who wouldn't sit down in the captain's chair, right? Mm-hmm. Riker is, you know, he'd be a great captain, right? He ends up becoming one eventually, but reluctantly. He ends up staying in his role as first officer of the Enterprise far longer than he probably needed to because he's not power hungry, but he'd be a great captain. He should be out there on the front lines, right? Picard is the captain who wouldn't become an admiral, or as we like to say, he wouldn't become a badmiral.
A badmiral.
Right, because he knows that if he is promoted to an admiral, he's going to have to make those hard choices. He's going to be a badmiral. He's going to be removed from where the action is, and he doesn't want to be promoted up into that level of authority. You know, is it because he's humble? Is it because he loses his influence? I'm not really sure. Probably all of the above. But Picard is the captain who won't be an admiral, right? And even Captain Kirk tells him, you know, don't let yourself get promoted off the bridge of the ship. So anyone in Star Trek who is hesitant to rise up the ranks, the Rikers and the Picards, I think they are good candidates for Philosopher King. And Picard, the irony with Picard is that he is probably the most philosophical captain of all of the captains that we've seen in Star Trek, right? So he's the best candidate for being a Philosopher King or a philosopher. I say a philosopher badmiral. That doesn't sound right, but but he'd be a great one, and he doesn't want to do it. And anytime you get a character like that in Star Trek, you're talking about the paradox of the Philosopher King. Anyone who doesn't want, and then you can see the careerists, though. I think what's interesting, there are careerists in Starfleet, right? People who just want to rise up the ranks as quickly as possible without necessarily cultivating the experience or the expertise or the perspective or the ideals of the Federation or of Starfleet. And that is, you know, something a little more like the Platonians, right? They've missed the point that as you rise up the ranks, you need to cultivate the understanding and the ideals that let you flourish in that role. And merely rising up the ranks for its own sake doesn't quite get you there. You're never going to become a philosopher king Indeed. That way.
Well, Zachary, just for my final thoughts, I just want to say I really enjoyed especially our conversation about Plato's stepchildren. I think that episode really in many ways paints the perfect picture, and by design, of this discussion that we're having today, the paradox of the Philosopher King. You know, in that episode, it all come down to a conversation that Captain Kirk had with Alexander, the Platonian dwarf. You know, Alexander wanted to know if there were people his size where Kirk came from. And I really appreciated what Captain Kirk said to Alexander. He said, "Where I come from, size, shape, or color makes no difference." And I've got to say, at the heart of this Philosopher King conversation really is the idea that size, shape, color, those things make no difference. It's about being just and virtuous. And I think that in my understanding of Plato's Republic, I think at the end of the day, that's what he was getting at. And I think that's idealized many, many ways, not just in Plato's Stepchildren, but throughout the Star Trek universe. That's my final thoughts.
Yeah, I think you're right about something. I think the idea that this is something I just love about fiction in general. I love it about Star Trek. I think whenever the question of ideals comes up, one of the most effective way of drawing out our ideals is to show something that is not an ideal, right? To show what's wrong with society. And by juxtaposing what's right and what's wrong about society inside an episode like this, you know, it reveals what our ideals should be, right? By putting, you mentioned the interracial kiss, right? By putting that inside this episode and making that sort of an issue for us today, right? Or back in 1960s, right? That was an issue, right? It was new. No one had seen it before. It was controversial, right? By putting that on screen, it forces us to go, wait a minute, we don't want a society that is stratified racially or otherwise, right? It makes us focus on what the ideal is. And putting this in the context of an episode about Plato is just brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure I have any real final thoughts that I haven't already expressed, except to say that Even the episodes of Star Trek that I find as not the best episodes, like this is, I would never have put Plato's Stepchildren on my list of favorite Star Trek episodes. It's towards the bottom, right? Yes, it's got the interracial kiss thing going on. It's known for that. It's the acting is terrible. It's sort of low budget third season Star Trek original series, right? There's 50 other episodes I would cite ahead of this episode. But even the episodes that I sort of go, yeah, this is not a great episode, are brilliant, right? Look at all the things we managed to mine out of this episode. Mm-hmm. You know, the talk about the proper role of authority, the role of cultivating virtues that lead to authority, the question of ideals versus all the things that are practically wrong with society. You pack all that in there, it's relevant to teaching philosophy. You've got all the stuff about Plato that the Platonians get right and they get wrong. Look at how fruitful this of a discussion this has really been with such a terrible episode of Star Trek. Right? And so I just love that even the bad episodes of Star Trek are so rich, and that's one of the things that really defines this franchise compared to other franchises for me. Like I'm a huge fan of the X-Files right now. I've been watching the new X-Files. I just watched the third episode last night. I mentioned that I watched the first two episodes last week, right? It's one of my favorite shows, but it's nowhere near as rich as Star Trek is philosophically, right?
No.
You know, I can't take any random episode of the X-Files and really mine the extent of philosophical or political or social commentary or conceptual commentary, the rich vocabulary of ideas that we talk about when we're talking about Star Trek and philosophy on Metatrex. I can't do that with the X-Files. I can't do that with Mystery Science Theater 3000. I can't do that with Star Wars. Maybe a little more Star Wars, but maybe more than the X-Files, but none of those hold a candle to the types of things you can talk about when you're talking about Star Trek, even the bad episodes. So again, no real final thoughts except to say that, you know, this episode is the Plato's Stepchildren that we've been spending most of our time talking about is really not the best episode of Star Trek. And it's very easy to look at that episode and say, yeah, that's not relevant to me today. And I guess my ultimate point is just that these questions, the questions of authority and the questions of democracy and questions of ideals and education and knowledge and what your responsibilities are, if you find yourself in a position of authority or find yourself in the role of an educator, every society since the dawn of time has had to face that question. And even in the future, you know, whatever Star Trek future ends up coming to fruition someday, knock on wood, they're going to have to face those same kinds of questions, right? That question of authority and its proper use mm-hmm. is not going to go away, no matter how ideal of a society you get. And so I guess I just want to highlight the relevance of this episode and the questions that it raises. You know, we sort of think of philosophy being really abstract, and every society has to deal with who should be in charge and what should they do, and what should the relationship between authority and the people be? And Plato had to deal with it. We have to deal with it. And even in the 24th century, they have to deal with it.
You bet.
That's my final thoughts.
Yes. And where else can you go and watch a Vulcan do the flamenco?
And there's that.
So, Zachary, it's been fun, almost too much fun, talking about the paradox of the philosopher king, or rather the paradox of the philanthropist grand negus, as you said today. But that isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So, here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It would be a lot of fun to be able to MST3K an episode like Arena, which, who doesn't love poking fun at a rock-throwing Gorn? I mean, come on, you know?
Can you find a rudimentary lathe?
Exactly. I wrote that on the Babel Conference today because Guy Fliegman from Galaxy Quest is the greatest character ever.
Earl Grey.
This 547-meter-long, 32-deck, 502-crew-member.
That's awesome.
To the journey!
Now we go to Once Upon a Time.
Neelix tries to...
Warp 5.
If they could have kind of told us, it's more of a future for us, but we're going to build up to the Star Trek you know. And Larry's comment back was, well, that would mean that they kind of were planning it out and they knew what they were doing ahead of time.
Buzzing.
That sounds right. Like Larry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I will say, if you want to see what it's really like when someone slices open a tauntaun to get inside to stay warm, like in the real world.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the movie. I'm like, really? Han Solo made it look so easy. This is what happens? This is terrifying.
The 602 Club.
It's about that transformation of getting Oliver to be able to see themselves as something more than vigilantes, but being heroes.
Yeah, and there is a lot of, I like that, because there is a lot in the quote-unquote, as you're calling it, the island story, which the island now is Hong Kong, as you pointed out.
Yeah, earlier. I mean, yeah, it's a little bigger than an island.
Literary Treks.
Dan, are you sure that flavor isn't something like a green liquid voodoo drink?
Oh, man. This.
Because that could be the flavor that we're going for.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us tremendously, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, it's okay. We got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website. You can grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discuss in this episode of Metatreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Find us on Twitter. Our handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM, and also find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search bar on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L, and it'll come right up. It's a closed group for Trek FM listeners only, so just hit join and someone will let you right in. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. And hey, we might even read yours like we did our two reviewers at the top of the show. So Zachary, when you're not watching shadows on the wall of a cave, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling. And Mike, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
They can also find me on Facebook. I'm a frequent contributor to the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is @CMichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, Will Wen, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our fabulous editor and producer, Dennis Costello. Thanks for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosopher has gone before.